wisdom is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, March 25th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Obama defends his financial rescue plan in a primetime press conference, part one of our conversation with Pratap Chatterjee about his new book, Halliburton's Army, and a look at why Thomas Sowers' nomination was revoked.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. President Obama went on the defensive yesterday evening in his second primetime news conference, defending his Treasury Secretary's plan to save the financial sector with $1 trillion of taxpayer money. The president took questions from reporters for nearly an hour during a conference that almost entirely focused on the economy. He was grilled about the bonuses received by AIG executives, the growing deficit budget, the healthcare issue, and others. Geithner's so-called private-public partnership would give investors federal money to buy up toxic assets. Many have criticized the plan as relying on investor greed as a fuel to fix the economy. But if the plan works, theoretically, banks would be able to free themselves of enough bad debt to be able to make good loans. That's a big if, however. Meanwhile, the president is planning an online town hall-style meeting on the economy tomorrow evening on the White House's website at whitehouse.gov. Joining me today to take a look at the press conference yesterday, as well as Geithner's ideas on how to save the economy, is Professor Richard Wolff. He is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and is featured in a new documentary by the Media Education Foundation called Capitalism Hits the Fan. Welcome to Uprising, Professor Wolff.
Welcome. Thank you for your welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks very much. I want to play some excerpts from the press conference yesterday, in particular, the opening remarks by the president on the plan that has been produced or that has been created by his Treasury Secretary. Let's take a listen to President Barack Obama yesterday.
Yesterday, Secretary Geithner announced a new plan that will partner government resources with private investment to buy up the assets that are preventing our banks from lending money. And we will continue to do whatever is necessary in the weeks ahead to ensure the banks Americans depend on have the money they need to lend, even if the economy gets worse. Finally, the most critical part of our strategy is to ensure that we do not return to an economic cycle of bubble and bust in this country. We know that an economy built on reckless speculation, inflated home prices, and maxed out credit cards does not create lasting wealth. It creates the illusion of prosperity, and it's endangered us all. The budget I submitted to Congress will build our economic recovery on a stronger foundation so that we don't face another crisis like this 10 or 20 years from now.
And that is President Barack Obama in his second primetime press conference. Richard Wolff, let's talk about first the plan itself by Timothy Geithner. Paul Krugman has come out this week, the Nobel Prize winning economist and writer for the New York Times, criticizing the so-called public-private partnership. What do you think of this plan, just at least from the perspective of freeing up banks to make loans that people desperately need?
Well, I think the underlying problem of both the Bush and now the Obama administrations is the assumption that if only you can pump enough money into the banks and the banking system generally, then that will solve our problems. It assumes, for example, that there's a vast collection of individuals and businesses just hopping eager to make borrowing an enormous part of their lives, and so they will rush to the banks to get this new money. But that's not the case. Our economy is in serious decline. People are holding back spending money, and they're holding back borrowing money. And businesses, seeing their customers dry up, are not in a mood to borrow either. So there's a fundamental flaw here in this assumption that everything will be made right if only you give enough money to the financial industry.
Well, what do you make of the plan that Obama has to basically give taxpayer money to investors? I mean, instead of the government itself buying up the toxic assets, which was a more direct way of doing it, but something that Paul Krugman and others have called Bush's plan, the cash for trash plan, instead of doing that, he's giving taxpayer money to, or wants to give taxpayer money to investors to buy up the toxic assets so that the risk is socialized, but the profits would be privatized.
Exactly. And unfortunately, I'm disappointed, to be honest with you, because it seems to me the same basic philosophy, carried out in a slightly different way, but the same basic philosophy operates here, which is you give money to the businesses at the top, hoping by a mixture of verbal pressure and hefty profit inducement to get them to do what the society needs. They have shown themselves, whether it be bankers, insurance companies, stock brokerages, they have shown themselves concerned, as they are legally bound to be, to do what's best for their company, with or without government help. And that continues to be good, perhaps, for their companies, but not for our economy. And it is disappointing that the president has decided to stay with that plan and provide money to private investors and banks and the same collection of folks who got us into this mess in the hope that they will do what is socially needed, even though they have shown themselves unable or unwilling to do that.
Now, even if one disagrees with the solution to buy up these toxic assets, in the long term, one may have a different approach, but in the short term, what is to be done with these toxic assets? What would you advise?
It's not so much, yes or no on the toxic assets. It's more the question of how might you combine an effort to unclog the credit markets that have frozen up because our economy is in trouble. How would you combine that with other things that are desperately needed? Let me give just two examples. When the situation got progressively worse the last time our capitalist economy collapsed in the 1930s, a conservative, basically, president, Franklin Roosevelt, eventually had to supplement the things he was doing for banks and investors by, for example, a direct program of government employment. You know, Mr. Obama is now hoping that by putting money in the hands of investors, they will buy toxic assets. That will give money to banks, who then hopefully will lend money to hopefully people and businesses who will borrow it, and then maybe we'll get some employment.
And the driver of all of this is supposed to be Wall Street greed, which some would say is
profitability.
Most agree that that's what got us in the mess in the first place.
Exactly. But it's also making the ultimate goal, which is to put Americans back to work, so that they have a decent job, that they have a decent income, that therefore they can make their mortgage payments and we don't have the foreclosures. It's making many ifs between the desire and the end product. What Franklin Roosevelt did and what Obama seems to not yet want to do is to say if the private sector cannot provide jobs or will not do it, then the government sector will. Look, it's real simple. We have enormous unmet social needs in America, rebuilding our cities, providing decent health care and education opportunities. We have millions of people looking for work who lost their jobs, and we're now currently working at what we call 70% capacity. That is, only 70% of our factories and offices are working. So we have the people who want the work, we have the places and raw materials for them to work on and with and the tools, and we have unmet social needs. But we don't put these things together, which is the most profound criticism of capitalism that one can really make.
But Dr. Wolf, the president said that in his as a result of his stimulus plan that he signed just a little over a month ago, that jobs were already being created and that the economy was being stimulated with job creation. What do you think?
Well, I think he found within minutes of having made the statement that he needed to correct it, as his assistants did, because the rate of job loss, that is, the rise in the rate of unemployment in the United States, has been so rapid and promises to continue to be so rapid that even if his stimulus plan succeeds, it would only reduce the amount of unemployment. It would certainly not end it, and he would certainly not put more people back to work. So it's actually a, and has been criticized for that, it's a plan that is very modest when compared to the scale of the economic decline that we face. And if you further add to that the fact that much of the rest of the world has been now dragged down because it was so focused on selling goods to America and borrowing money and lending money here, that we have not yet felt the impact of the rest of the world's decline, which will show up as reduced demands for American exports, that will punish us with higher unemployment, and so on and so on. So that my guess is that the president's plan, at best, will slow the decline, but it is not big enough, and it is not bold enough, and it is not direct enough to reverse it.
I'm speaking with Professor Richard Wolff. He's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's featured in a new film by the Media Education Foundation called Capitalism Hits the Fan. Professor Wolff, I'd like to play a couple more excerpts from the press conference yesterday, the first one responding to the issue of the AIG bonuses that has been so controversial. Here again is President Obama from his primetime press conference yesterday.
I'm as angry as anybody about those bonuses that went to some of the very same individuals who brought our financial system to its knees, partly because it's yet another symptom. At the same time, the rest of us can't afford to demonize every investor or entrepreneur who seeks to make a profit. That drive is what has always fueled our prosperity, and it is what will ultimately get these banks lending and our economy moving once more.
And that is President Obama. We had a little technical glitch there, but President Obama talking about the AIG bonuses and how he's extremely angry, but then a little bit, just a minute later, talking about how we mustn't demonize the investors and that it is really they and their work that fuels our economy. He even said it always has fueled our economy. Richard Wolff, how do you respond to that, given that the consumer-based economy of this country is, what, say, 4 to 5 decades old?
Yes, I would argue that in this case, I think the president is quite right. That is, in the following sense, certainly we are all outraged, not just at these bonuses and not just at the fact that they are fueled by and funded by our tax money. We ought to be actually angry about even more than that, which is the last 30 years have seen the greatest boom in high salaries of top corporate executives that we've ever had in our society. It's a little strange to be suddenly angry when we should have been angry for 30 years at the growing disparity between rich and poor generally.
Good point.
And but the problem with the president's view is this peculiar notion of focusing on the profit motive as getting the credit for making our economy successful or powerful. That's a very strange logic. Most of the work done in our society to make the goods and services we have enjoyed and to make them more abundant is to the credit of the working people. I mean, let's be honest here. The work in a factory is done by everybody. It is not in some special way done by the people who gain the profits. If you ever work in a factory or if you ever work in an office, you know pretty well that there are lots of people at the very top who are there for reasons that have very little to do with how hard the work is and how hard the output is and how well it's done. It is a little strange. You know, we can do without profit as long as we have the labor. But all the profiting in the world goes nowhere if there isn't the labor underneath it. So I find that a very strange kind of logic. But I agree with the president on one point. Demonizing this or that group, financiers, bankers, AIG executives, misses the point. By changing these executives, by taking away their bonuses, we don't change the basic system, and therefore we're not going to get out of this mess. When President Obama says that what he wants to do is to make sure not only that we get out of this crisis, but that we don't face these recurring crises, he is saying something that Franklin Roosevelt said and that every president who's been in charge when we've had an economic downturn has said. But the point is, none of them ever changed or challenged the system we live with, and that's why, despite their intentions, we keep having economic cycles and downturns, and now we're in the worst one in 75 years since the last big crash that capitalism suffered. I think it's long overdue to ask basic questions about how business is organized, how we organize our economy, because we're not succeeding with these financial maneuvers and these public-private partnerships. All of this repertoire of response hasn't done the job, and the basic questions, therefore, have to be asked.
Professor Wolf, Barack Obama himself has said repeatedly that time is of the essence, that this economy is failing so fast and so widely and so deeply that any time wasted is going to be catastrophic and prolong the disaster. And yet there are promising outlooks that the economy is going to recover in 12 months. How do you feel about the fact that these essentially failed models are being tried over and over again at a time when we really can't afford to try them?
I think that what you're seeing is a fundamental belief that all the leaders of capitalist countries have come to believe, which is when things go bad, or as in the name of my film, when capitalism hits the fan, it's very important for the chief executives of large corporations and for the leading political figures in the society to talk up the economy, to say it's hit bottom, it's reached a turning point. Americans maybe have a short memory, but President Bush, before he left office, was wont to say repeatedly that the bottom is in view, we have turned the corner. This kind of boosterism, if you like, is thought to be good leadership. And so the president is going to talk about what happens in 12 months. Let me debunk that just in the following way. If you and I were having this conversation 12 months ago, and you asked me what I foresaw, and had I been able to say something close to the reality we're now in, you would never have invited me back on the program because you would have thought I was crazy, and most Americans would have thought I was crazy. And that's a sign that we don't know what's going to happen 12 months down the road. We never do. And the prediction about that has as much real value as going to the amusement park and having that lady look at the lines in your hand and predict your love life in the future. It's an amusement. It shouldn't be taken seriously. Mm. The reality is, and Mr. Obama, I'm sure, is very acutely informed about and aware of it, the reality is we are in the worst economic decline in our lifetimes. And it is more global, more profound. It is based on the fact that for the last 30 years, the real wages of American workers have not been increased. An hour of labor in America today earns you as much in terms of what you can actually afford to buy as an hour of labor in the 1970s. Meanwhile, profits have gone crazy because workers have become more productive over the last 3 years, even though their wages never went up. This is the fundamental problem, a fundamental difference between a working class which has had to borrow money to keep its standard of living going, and a very small part of the population that's been having a roaring good time on explosive profits. Only if you address why that happened and how that has to be now dramatically changed are you going to deal with the underlying reality, and nothing that neither Bush nor Obama have yet proposed addresses that question.
Well, Richard Wolf, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back on. Thanks so much.
I'd love to be back on again, and I appreciate your invitation.
Dr. Richard Wolf is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He's featured in a new Media Education Foundation documentary called Capitalism Hits the Fan. Later in the hour, we'll speak with Arnaldo Garcia to talk about why Barack Obama's administration revoked the nomination of Thomas Saenz to the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. Well, also, after today's Subversive Historian and this week's Who Said That contest, hear part one of an in-depth conversation with independent journalist Pratap Chatterjee about his new book, Halliburton's Army. Stay tuned.
Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day, on March 25, 1931, nine African-American youths were removed from a Southern Railroad train and taken to a jail in Scottsboro, Alabama. Soon to be known around the world as the Scottsboro Nine, six of the youths were accused by Victoria Price, a white woman, of gang raping her. The other three were reasoned to have done the same to another white woman, Ruby Bates. The trial of the Scottsboro Nine began 12 days later, resulting in eight death penalty convictions by what else? An all-white jury. A new trial for the defendants was eventually granted, as the first was deemed unfair. The Communist Party took up the cause of the Scottsboro Nine, employing the legal talents of Samuel Leibovitz to prove their innocence. In a second trial, another all-white jury returned guilty verdicts. After these convictions were once again overturned, Leibovitz's legal team had the charges of four of the nine dropped, while others were given lengthy prison sentences. They all eventually made their way out, but it begs the question, with liberty and justice for all? For Uprising, this is your truth professor, saying it's no mystery, why they conceal our people's history.
No more lies.
And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who says that? Who says that?
Who is it?
So what do you call yourself? Huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
Who are you?
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really don't know.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who?
Who?
I've heard that before.
And before we go to our next story, it's time now for this week's edition of Who Said That? It's a weekly contest in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives, where each week we play you a short soundbite from the vault of the archives, and we ask you to tell us who said that. All you have to do is call in and identify the voice, and we'll send you the CD from the Pacifica Radio Archives that featured the clip. Let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
Because I happen to believe that it is only by masses of Negroes pushing at the local level, going into stores and refusing to leave until they're served, things which the federal government will not do for them, these are the things which are going to be the beginning of the breakdown.
And if you know who that is, and if you haven't won yet, call us right now at 818-985-5735 with your best guess. That's 818-985-KPFK. Halliburton, the subsidiary of Kellogg Brown & Root, is in the news again, this time being charged with attempted bribery in Nigeria to buy liquefied natural gas facilities. Two British citizens working for the company, formerly headed by former Vice President Dick Cheney, now face charges, according to the U.S. Justice Department. Cheney's leadership of Halliburton is only one among many criticisms levied at Halliburton over the past years, particularly since the start of the Iraq War more than 6 years ago. The company received billions of dollars in government contracts to provide services to forces stationed in Iraq and has been accused of overcharging, bribery, and kickbacks. The company was also the subject of a documentary by progressive filmmaker Robert Greenwald called Iraq for Sale. And now a new book by Corp Watch's Pratap Chatterjee details the history of how Halliburton and its parent company, KBR, were catapulted into the world of Washington power politics, going all the way back to World War II. According to Chatterjee, the new way in which wars are fought, freeing up an all-volunteer army from menial tasks, ensures that companies like Halliburton will continue to profit from war. Pratap Chatterjee is the managing editor of Corp Watch, and the full title of his book is Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War. I spoke with him recently. Today we play you part one of our interview.
Halliburton's Army is about how the U.S. military has transformed from a draft army to a volunteer army. It's about how America has reinvented the way it goes to war by using migrant labor, by using a system of treating soldiers with the amenities of the 21st century so that they will engage in ideological wars. I'm worried now, and I believe that Obama and the Pentagon in the future will use Halliburton's army to go to more wars of choice, and that this, in fact, is the way of the future. I think it's very important to understand that this is not something that is confined to the Bush and Cheney administration. This is very much what you're going to see in the next 4, 8, 12, 20 years.
Start by explaining for us exactly what Halliburton does in Iraq in exchange for U.S. tax dollars.
Okay, Halliburton, which is based in Houston, has a subsidiary called Kellogg Brown & Root. The two have separated, they've kind of gotten divorced, and now Kellogg Brown & Root is the company that does the work in Iraq. But for 40 years, KBR was actually a subsidiary of Halliburton, and its work in war zones dates back decades. You know, in Vietnam, they were building bases, and they were involved in Bosnia and Kosovo, they're involved in Somalia. In Iraq, what they're doing is actually an expansion of what they've done before, which is they do everything that is pretty much dirty and dull. They cook food, they clean toilets, they build bases, they drive trucks, they do flight manifests. They manage all the mundane logistics that the U.S. military needs done. So if Napoleon once said an army marches on its stomach, Halliburton slash KBR feeds that stomach.
And so stuff that the army would normally do itself or did do, for example, in Vietnam and other wars.
That's exactly right. And here is the key difference between the U.S. war in Vietnam and the U.S. war in Iraq. In Vietnam, the U.S. had a draft army. Young men could be called up, you know, teenagers sent to war, put through boot camp, and whether they liked it or not, unless they had enough money, you know, they were George Bush or Dick Cheney, they had to go to war. And when they got there, they had to peel potatoes, they lived in the jungle, you know, they got malaria, they were shot at, they might have died in the battlefield, they came back gaunt, you know, skinny, traumatized, etc. Today, with the volunteer army, that's virtually impossible. And so the Pentagon has evolved over the last 40 years, and this is something that is not uniquely Republican, although the Republicans have put their own stamp in expanding this. This is something that has happened across both parties in the last 40 years. So today, if you go to Iraq, instead of coming back 15 pounds lighter as a soldier, you will actually come back 10 pounds heavier.
On average?
The reason, on an average. There's Halliburton's army, which is 50,000 people, basically does all the dirty and dull work. And when you go to, there are 160,000 troops in Iraq, and there are 175,000 contractors. So there's, in fact, more contractors than there are soldiers. 50,000 of these contractors are people doing the mundane logistics, the kind of thing that a quartermaster would have done and commissioned, you know, in Vietnam or Korea or some such thing. Now this is all done by workers from other countries. Americans, but largely, in fact, 80% of them are workers from India, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, Fiji, former Soviet Republic of Georgia, that sort of thing, Bangladesh, mostly low-wage workers. And what they do is make sure that American soldiers get what they would like in today's 21st century. Now, what does a 21st century teenager want? Walmart, McDonald's, Xboxes. And you get that on a U.S. military base. If you go to a big base in particular, this is maybe not true in a small little combat outpost, Zomat in Afghanistan, but if you're at logistical supply area Anaconda or any medium-sized base, you will find a dining facility in which you will get several different options for a meal. You will get five kinds of ice cream. You will get steak. You will get apple pie. You will get pumpkin pie. At Easter, you will get chocolate-covered bunnies. You will get access to a video game arcade where you can play war games on a computer screen when you're not actually fighting that in the sky or whatever. You can play Guitar Hero. You can go to a mall where you will buy Burger King. You can get Pizza Hut. You could buy a mountain bike. A U.S. military base today serves the American teenager in a way that is very dissimilar to what they would have seen in the trenches of the Second World War in France or the Netherlands.
So what you're saying is that not only is the arrangement between Halliburton, KBR, and the government enabling the army to free its soldiers up from doing the dirty work, but that work is outsourced to people from third countries, largely from poor countries. And you know, tell us about these workers now. And you mentioned several countries that they come from, but how are they recruited? What are they paid? What are the conditions they they work in.
Okay. Now, the conditions people, third country nationals, as they're called, TCNs, work in are very different from the way conditions that American soldiers or American workers live in. So they will live, they will typically, if you're a Bangladeshi worker doing cleaning work on a base in Kuwait, and these are actual numbers from people I've met, you're making about $90 a month. If you're, let's say, doing the same job in Iraq, you're making $300 a month. If you're a cashier, you'll be paid $1,000 a month. So that's sort of an idea of wages that a lot of the workers, the subcontractors to KBR, get paid. They are typically given free lodging. They will not eat in the same dining facilities. They won't have steak and lobster tails and five kinds of ice cream. They'll be served Indian food on an Indian facility, and they will live, 12 to often a shipping container. And if they get injured, rather than being treated in the military hospital, they get shipped back home. So the working conditions are very different. Now, I want to point out that this is, in fact, quite common in the Middle East. And, in fact, if you go to Dubai or Kuwait, that is, in fact, how most of the Gulf states are run. So if you go to Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Fujairah, Bahrain, you will find that most of the country, Dubai, for example, is 85% migrant workers. And those migrant workers have come from India knowing fully well they're going to be paid $100 a month, or maybe they hope they'll be making $500 a month. But it has been a huge source of income for countries in South and Southeast Asia. In fact, the entire Philippines national debt is effectively paid off by migrant labor. So the U.S. has adapted a model that has been working in the Gulf states and uses that in its military bases to provide for its soldiers. And in fact, this is not that this was actually done in Iraq. When Iraq was wealthy and Iraq sent its men to the front with Iran, they brought in 1 million Egyptians to do the work that the Iraqi men used to do, driving buses and cleaning streets that they were no longer doing. So the system of migrant labor, which is exploitative, is still, however, common, and it is, in fact, whereas there are many people who are tricked into doing this work, there's a lot of people who've also come along to do it because it's a way to make money and send it back home to their families.
Halliburton has just adopted this model.
Halliburton KBR has adopted a model that's existed in the Gulf states for a long time.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the logistical supply area, Anaconda, which you mentioned earlier. You describe it in your book. You know, when one sort of walks into it, what does one see, and how is its, how is it enhanced, if you will, or what is the role that Halliburton KBR plays at Anaconda?
Well, Anaconda, actually, it's interesting that you say if you walk into Anaconda, you can't actually walk into Anaconda.
Right.
You generally fly into Anaconda. And you fly in typically with the military on, let's say, something like the various military airlines. The one I flew in on was something called Catfish Air, which was set up by the Mississippi National Guard.
And you were just a credentialed journalist?
I was a credentialed journalist. I was embedded with the U.S. military representing Pacifica. And they asked me, they invited me in, and I signed up on a manifest. A KBR worker in Baghdad put me on a manifest.
And they knew you were with Pacifica, and they
No, absolutely, yeah. Pacifica is seen as a legitimate organization. When I walked in, my public affairs officer said, in Vietnam, a radio station from Berkeley would never have made it into a military base. But today, because we are open and we are willing to show you anything, you're very welcome here, and we're happy to. And and when I would talk on KPFA in Berkeley, they would listen to the recordings. They would come back and tell me, I mean, this is the amazing thing about technology today and, you know, globalization of the Internet. You know, 5 minutes after my broadcast, they would come back and said, what you said was not wrong. We need to re-educate you and send me in to meet somebody else from the military to show me how I was wrong in my opinion of what I had seen.
So when you fly into Anaconda, what's it look like?
When you fly, well, Anaconda is a small town. It is, 35,000 people. And so when you enter, it actually looks very like a U.S. military base anywhere in the world. You know, there's these tent cities. They use these fairly sophisticated tents that can be air-conditioned in summer and heated in winter. There are these giant dining facilities that can feed 1,000 soldiers. And when you go there, you have hundreds of Indian cooks, cooking up food, serving it. You have a short order chef. You have refrigerators full of ice cream and water and juice and that sort of thing. You have these giant trucks that have driven all the way from Kuwait with, you know, these big Thermo King, Mercedes-Benz trucks with Thermo King, refrigeration, and then delivering food. So you are actually walking into, I mean, you can hear sometimes, particularly at night, you know, mortar fire around the base. But typically, especially these days when that mortar fire, you know, as the amount of attacks has decreased. They used to call it Mortaritaville. But now it's not quite as, especially if you're in the center, you don't hear as much. You know, there's a movie theater there. There's a swimming pool there. You know, it is intended to give American soldiers a taste of home. And especially truck drivers and convoy security, when they come there from a small outpost, you know, they just freak out because they're like, here we are. You know, I took pictures of them, you know, hanging out by the pool and playing volleyball. And they were delighted to be in this little slice of America right bang in the middle of Iraq.
My guest is Pratap Chatterjee. We're talking about his new book, Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War. Now, when most people on Pacifica hear Halliburton, we often think right away of Dick Cheney, who is featured throughout your book, former CEO of Halliburton. Talk about him as well as Donald Rumsfeld and the role that they played, not necessarily, I mean, not right away about the role they played in the last few years where Iraq was concerned, but even historically, how they've been entwined with Halliburton as well, and this way, this new way of fighting wars.
Well, one of the questions that people ask me a lot is, did Cheney give Halliburton the contract? I've been looking for 7 years, and I haven't really found much evidence of that. And it's possible that I missed it. You know, it was right in front of me, I didn't see it. But I actually think now that's the wrong question. The question is, why did Halliburton hire Cheney as opposed to the other way around? And really, it's a very simple answer. It's nepotism. It's the revolving door. When you rise to a high rank in the U.S. government or in the Pentagon, you are automatically eligible to go be senior management in a company or sit on a board. And the way all of these big companies get contracts is because their boards are stuffed with, you know, ex-government politicians and government bureaucrats and what have you. So it was par for the course for Halliburton to hire Dick Cheney to be CEO. They didn't really need him, but it is a system of revolving doors where these people automatically get on, and it helps them. It reduces, in fact, when Dick Cheney left Halliburton, their lobbying budget went down by 50%. They didn't need to spend any money anymore on lobbying because they already knew people in the field. So he didn't have to give them the contract directly. The contract was theirs partly because they already had all the people who once ran military logistics were now working for the company. They knew went to bid for the contract. They knew what to write in the bid. So nobody had to pay $1 million or $1 billion or $1 trillion in a bribe to get it. It was legal and easily justified on grounds of national security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the role of Cheney and Rumsfeld, one of the ironic things actually about Rumsfeld, who was Secretary of Defense, was that in May 1966, he went to Vietnam as then a member of the House of Representatives to investigate Brown and Root, the subsidiary of Halliburton that was building the bases in Vietnam. And when he came back, he stood on the floor of Congress and he said, this company doesn't have receipts. They are overcharging. They're paying off the president, Lyndon B. Johnson at the time. The potential for waste and profiteering under this contract is substantial. So ironically, this
Rumsfeld
man who was, Rumsfeld was protesting Brown and Root in Congress in 1966. So it's deeply ironic that 35 years later, the man decided, and really he is Secretary of Defense more than Dick Cheney, was the one who commissioned at a senior level Brown and Root to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. But to imagine that he simply had a turnabout or he decided he can make a lot of money is to in fact forget all the intervening years of history. Because out of Vietnam, after the U.S. left Vietnam and the draft became completely untenable, it behooved the Pentagon to figure out a way to get soldiers to sign up and go to war. And so contracts, which under Lyndon B. Johnson were given to Brown and Root, were continued under Reagan, the contract to build Diego Garcia was in fact under Ronald Reagan in 1982. But then fast forward to 1991, and here you have a little interesting conundrum. In the first Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War, as it's often known in the United States, they used a lot of contractors. So Dick Cheney was the Secretary of Defense then. Disaster. These guys didn't coordinate with each other. A lot of people were very unhappy. So Cheney turned to Brown and Root and said, can you figure out how to maybe coordinate all of this? And he used a theory that had been created, a paper that had been created by General John Wickham in 1985. And he said, figure out how we can implement this. And they went off and they figured out, you know, they said, okay, this is the way we can actually help manage all these disparate hundreds of contractors in the desert. So that, and the way you do it is you have one contractor on top of the others who manages everything. The managing contractor. Now, the first company, the first time this contract was put into place was under Bill Clinton in Bosnia. In fact, before Dick Cheney became CEO, and Dick Cheney became CEO in August of 1995. I think the month before that is when he hadn't even interviewed for the job when they got the contract there. So the first $1 billion contract in which Halliburton / Brown and Root cooked for the soldiers, cleaned the toilets, and built bases was actually a Clinton-era contract in Bosnia and later in Kosovo. Cheney, according to the record, said he didn't want to have anything to do with it because he felt like there was a conflict of interest. But what I'm trying to establish here is there's a continuum from LBJ to Reagan to Bush and Senior to Clinton to Bush Jr. and Cheney and now Obama, in which the Pentagon has outsourced everything that's dirty and dull, you know, to third world workers in order to be able to take Americans and to war and have them not object. And this we'll see in the future under Obama, whether we like it or not.
Pratap, how good a job is KBR doing in Iraq today and over the past several years? There has been a lot of criticism. You mentioned Rumsfeld's critique in the Vietnam era of overcharging, et cetera. A lot of allegations just over the past few years, a big controversy regarding Halliburton, not just with the Cheney connection, but with the no-bid contracts and the overcharging, the lack of receipts, the jet-setting, and these disappeared dollars. How much of that is true?
Some of it is true. A lot of it is not true. The problem is when the Pentagon outsourced military logistics to companies like KBR, they also outsourced the system of management of contracts, of acquisition, of procurement, and the auditing of these contracts. So you have to separate these two things. On the one hand, they said, we need private contractors to cook food and clean toilets. And they also said, we want a contractor to oversee the contractor that does this. So inherently you have a contradiction because you have one contractor in charge of another contractor, both of whom are for profit. They can actually work together, you know, to maximize their profits. Now, at the end of the day, are you saving money? Well, you could save money if you made sure that the person that was overseeing the people doing the work was doing a good job. And at the end of the day, remember, it costs $100,000 to train a soldier in boot camp. It costs another $30,000, $40,000 a year to give them a salary. When they leave the military, they go to college, they get veterans benefits, disability benefits. It costs a lot to pay for an American soldier, easily $250,000. On the other hand, if you hire an Indian and you pay them $5,000 a year, you're going to save a bunch of money. So,
but there are also corporate CEOs earning a lot of money at the top and a lot of middle managers too.
They are middle managers. The bulk of workers at Halliburton KBR are actually third country nationals. 40,000 out of 50,000 are third country nationals. Will the U.S. military save money? In theory, it could save money. If you cut out the middle management, if you cut out the system of subcontracting, there's no reason why the U.S. military in hiring workers from India could not save money there. And is it saving money? Perhaps it is. But the issue isn't so much that. If it's purely tax dollars you're looking for, you need to make sure that you oversee. And Obama can do this, and he says he'll do it. We'll see if he does. One of the other problems, apart from the fact that KBR was overseeing subcontractors and therefore they had no incentive to save money, and KBR itself was being managed, was being checked up on by, is currently being checked up upon by a British company called Serco, is you have Serco looking at KBR, which is looking at Prime Projects International. You have a whole, you know, you have a cabal, maybe, if you want, of contractors who have no incentive to save money because, you know, if they complain about the next company, maybe they'll lose their contract.
Pratap Chatterjee is managing editor of CorpWatch and author of Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War. We've been listening to part one of my interview, tomorrow part two. After this short break, we will speak with Arnaldo Garcia about Thomas Sciens and why he was revoked his nomination for the top civil rights post in this country. Stay tuned.
The 2009 KPFK local station board is currently looking for a treasurer and a secretary. The secretary is responsible for taking notes at local station board meetings, preparing and posting the minutes of the meetings online at kpfk.org. The treasurer reviews the monthly financial statements and ensures that the local station board's finance committee meets and functions. These are volunteer positions. The bylaws do not require the treasurer or secretary to be a local station board member. Anyone can apply. To apply and for more information, contact Steve at 818-985-2711, extension 0, or go to kpfk.org.
Welcome back to Uprising. Before we go to our last story of the day, the winner of this week's Who Said That contest is Kevin Jackson. Congratulations, Kevin, for guessing the correct answer, which is Bayard Rustin. A little bit of background, Bayard Rustin was best known for helping to found both the Congress of Racial Equality and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was one of the organizers of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. He advised Martin Luther King on Gandhian tactics as King organized the public transport boycott. And later in his life, he became a strong advocate of gay and lesbian rights. And we'll send a copy of the CD from our archives. It's a 1960 CD that was produced right here at KPFK called Negro Rights in Africa and America with Kenneth Duanda and Bayard Rustin. Let's take another listen to the clip we played earlier.
Because I happen to believe that it is only by masses of Negroes pushing at the local level, going into stores and refusing to leave until they're served. Things which the federal government will not do for them, these are the things which are going to be the beginning of the breakdown.
That's Bayard Rustin's voice. For those of you who didn't win, you can order the CD that this clip is featured from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. The Obama administration recently selected Thomas Perez, Maryland's labor secretary, to run the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division. Though Perez, a first-generation Dominican American, has served on the boards of two immigration organizations, the president's move is being called a flinch on immigration by a New York Times editorial published yesterday. Criticism has centered on why the L.A.-based civil rights attorney Thomas Sciens was not offered the job after having been seen as the leading candidate. Sciens's record as the former top litigator for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund has been markedly strong on immigrants' rights issues. He's been instrumental in helping defeat Proposition 187's implementation in California while defending the human rights of day laborers. With speculation growing that Thomas Sciens would be selected for the post, anti-immigrant groups went on the offensive, attacking his record and polarizing the debate before it even started. In a statement, the National Council of La Raza expressed its profound disappointment in the Obama administration's passing up of Sciens. La Opinion also joined the New York Times in voicing their concern for Obama's change in position. My guest this morning is Arnaldo Garcia, Enforcement Project Director at the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Welcome to Uprising, Arnaldo.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, a little bit about Thomas Sciens. What do you think role that he would have played, what sort of role he would have played in the civil rights position at the Justice Department had he been picked? Would this have been a marked change from previous positions in that area?
Yeah, it was very troubling that he was yanked, right, because to us it represents a lack of commitment to one of our main issues, which is the restoring of rights and liberties to all immigrants in the United States. That's one of the big problems. And someone like Sciens in the Department of Justice, who understood the issues and and the issues around fairness and just basic plain fairness and equality, this would have really struck a blow to some of the another big issue, which is that we have to change the climate before we even talk about what kind of reforms we need. Because under this climate, right, given a very fair and qualified person is being attacked even before the process started, doesn't bode well for any other proposal that come out. A lot of people are saying that maybe Obama, you know, has a public side of it, of, you know, having enthusiasm for what's called comprehensive immigration reform. I don't think his enthusiasm has wavered. However, what we're more wary of is exactly what type of reform he would propose that would actually be one of those key, would provide one of those keystone issues, which is restoring the rights of our communities. So far, he's articulated an approach that doesn't inspire hope in us. For example, they're just about to implement a new generation of militarization of border and immigration control. And when this is taking place, restores or reinforces the status quo that now exists of raids, abuses in immigration enforcement and detention and deportations.
Arnaldo, Thomas Saenz is a senior advisor to LA Mayor Villaraigosa. Certainly his position on immigrants' rights have been very good, but is he a radical by any means?
Oh, of course not. He's not. He's not a radical. And right now, while we do need radicals, we do need people that can think about the fundamental basic issues of getting our communities out of crisis. And one of those, of course, is just restoring fairness and rights to the process that we all are being subjected to right now.
Now, what about Thomas Perez, the labor attorney from Maryland? What about his qualifications?
I think that whether Saenz or Perez had been or would be appointed, that they would still be operating in this alliance that Obama's operating under with, you know, that he's trying to push for immigration reform, which hasn't been articulated other than what we've seen on the ground, right, and it's not very promising. I don't know that it's going to make a qualitative difference, right, because I think that there's three centers of focus here. One is, of course, the executive office, is particularly the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security, and Congress, right, and in those three areas, right, there's a very tenuous balance of what has been discussed for immigration reform, and there's been an even more tenuous balance about how to take the steps forward, right? Our ideal way would be to say, which we're saying, is to stop the raids, and actually stopping the raids would not be enough because overwhelming majority of people, 98% of all people, are not being detained or deported through raids. So we would say suspend the detention and deportations, all of them, and investigate the abuses, restore our rights. And then I think that we would have a better chance of whoever, whether it's Pettus or Saenz, being in the Department of Justice in this case.
But who would have been more likely to take that approach? Perez, who, by the way, is Maryland's labor secretary, Perez or Saenz?
Well, I have my druthers, right? Of course, Saenz would have been the better choice because he has a very proven track record in defending the rights of the civil rights of all persons in the United States, you know, with his work on Prop 187, the defending day laborers. So it's very, very clear. Now, someone with a labor background also provides some hope, right, because he'll understand that some of the issues of defending the labor rights, restoring and protecting labor rights is also very critical to our communities. It's not just about immigration reform.
Do you think that the right-wing forces that Obama seems to have, and this is speculation, seems to have given into, are going to be happy with Thomas Perez, or are they also going to be disappointed with them?
Well, you know, they've said they probably are not going to be very happy with him either, but they've set a very important tone in the climate, right, which they've reasserted it and strengthened it. And I think our side needs to do the same thing. We have to reassert and strengthen the need for changing the climate and for Obama and others in Congress to take a really strong role and roll it back and not be pushed back by this. And
so you're saying that obvious. They created a serious pressure at the bottom Obama responded to?
Yeah, and of course, maybe he's picking and choosing his fights, which any sane individual will do, and Obama's doing his thing by that. But at the same time, by yanking Saenz's nomination, it doesn't send a strong signal that we will actually change the status quo, change the climate, and do some really basic things that do not require comprehensive immigration reform, which not everybody supports to begin with in its present configuration.
Arnaldo Garcia, the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, very briefly, how active are you in trying to get the ear of the Obama administration, and can you give a website?
Well, yes. So we sent a letter to Obama with four basic issues around raids, immigration law enforcement and collaboration, the border militarization and migrant deaths, and restoring civil liberties as a prerequisite for opening the path to what we call a socially just legalization.
And is that letter on your website?
It's on our website, and our website is www.nnirr.org.
Arnaldo Garcia, I'm sorry this had to be so short.
No, thank you
so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Arnaldo Garcia is the Enforcement Project Director at the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, online at nnirr.org. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, John F. Kennedy once said, in giving rights to others which belong to them, we give rights to ourselves and to our country. And that's John F. Kennedy. That's Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Jesse Wood is our intern. Nadia Richardson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of the show after 10 a.m. on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening and see you tomorrow at 8.